and a bit on past, present, and future, and this quality we call mindfulness. So the word mindfulness that we use to mean being present with something or being intimate with it, being with or aware of an experience as it's happening, which means through the senses as it's happening. The word itself, in Pali and Sanskrit, in the early languages, means literally memory or remembering. The Pali word is sati, the Sanskrit word is smriti. And in its early usage, it was a quality literally meaning memorization, probably of texts and ritual chants. So, you know, the very earliest traditions, the pre-Buddhist and pre-yoga traditions that we have access to, the Vedic religion in ancient India was an oral tradition where long bodies of chanting and ritual were memorized very precisely. And as with any oral tradition, the process of remembering things in detail is profoundly important. You know, and we have aids and guidelines toward how to remember from all of the ancient oral traditions. You know, one of the Western versions from the kind of medieval tradition was the idea of visualizing a mansion with many rooms, and the rooms have all these details in them. And you would embed in the details of the rooms, so a visual image essentially in your mind, you would embed the kind of reminders of the things you were remembering. Right? So, you know, I walk into the library and I look over and the green lamp reminds me of faith. And then the table under the lamp with its ornate edges reminds me of energy, or whatever the qualities were. And this is generally a kind of religious, philosophical kind of memorization. In the Indian traditions, and very much expressed in the Buddhist traditions, we get supports for memorization like everything coming in lists, and the lists being repeated again and again in the teachings. Or stock phrases repeated again and again in the teachings. So if you read the early suttas or discourses, sutras, you find, especially, and it's really nice to read them out loud because they repeat themselves a lot. And so they get into a kind of almost like a sing-song sort of quality, and you learn these various phrases that indicate things. So in so many of the discourses, when the Buddha speaks about the practice of meditation specifically, when he says, like, you know, everything else having been done, like you've gotten ordained as a monk or a nun, or you've set aside time and you've found a spot that's peaceful and clean, and you sit down and you cross the body and you bring mindfulness to the forefront. And all of these, this whole sequence is a sequence that gets said again and again in the texts. And to describe the meditation itself, the text says, and the practitioner enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is the first absorption state, mental gathering state, which is characterized by the aiming and sustaining of thought or attention, and by the quality of pleasure and non-distraction. And it goes on like that, and you end up knowing these phrases because they are repeated again and again. And this is one of the signs of the oral tradition. So mindfulness, then, we think of it as this kind of, you know, just being radically present quality. And that's probably something that is modern Western, as we learned, not from the early Buddhist tradition, but from Zen, that has this emphasis on radical presence without thought. But the word in its earlier renditions, talking about memory, coming out of the memorization of texts, starts to have a meaning or a valence, a quality that that speaks to a method of analyzing our experience, and this is the method that leads to the insight or clear seeing that's called vipassana. Vipassana means to see clearly, and that method is to be aware of, in a very clear way, the sequence of experiences that we encounter. So it's not just be really present for this one moment. It's actually be present in a continuous way such that I could remember or track a sequence of experiences. And there's this thing about tracking through a sequence of experiences. So it's very much not actually a process that's separate from memory or story. We think of mindfulness sometimes as a kind of radical no future, no past practice. It's a little misleading. You have to do a kind of radical no future, no past gesture in order to get really connected to something that's happening, right? Like, in order for me not to be lost in a story about the ache in my body or about the heartbreak I'm having or about what I'm going to do next week, but just be in contact with the body as sensation and breath, I have to let go of the story of past and future. But having done that, like, what about that? Right? Is that in and of itself liberating? And the suggestion would be no, it's not actually. That in and of itself is a meditative concentration, and so it can be calming, it can be grounding, it can be healing in some ways of the tendency to wander or be distracted or sleepwalk. But that in and of itself is not liberation. And the reason it's not liberation is because being present is a state that's the result of conditions. Like, I could do it because I got enough sleep last night, the toddler was happy this afternoon, so I was happy, so I'm happy now, because I ate a decent dinner, because I'm not stressed about my work this week, because I like being here, whatever it is. And there's enough pleasure and safety, basically. It's the trauma footnote. There's enough pleasure and safety that my mind can relax from its vigilance about, like, oh no, something's going to go wrong, or what happened, or I don't have the energy to do this. When all of those conditions are in place, then, the breath, the body, seeing, hearing, presence. It's not liberating because I can't guarantee those conditions. I certainly can't guarantee good sleep, and I can't guarantee a happy toddler, and those two are not disconnected. Huh. I can't guarantee having eaten. I can't guarantee being healthy. I can't guarantee being in safe conditions. But the practice of cultivating those safe conditions and then resting in pleasure and ease and centeredness is the foundation for remembering what's happening moment to moment. Remembering happens when I am undistracted enough to stay with a sequence of experiences. So like when you're really tired late at night, or your mind's kind of foggy, or you're absorbed in something from work or a relationship or something, and you're trying to read a difficult book, and you kind of read the paragraph, and then you sort of space out a bit, or you think about your thing, and you look at the paragraph and it makes no sense, and you start over. And you kind of read it, and then you just kind of start over, and you forget where you were, and you read it three times, and then you just give up, right? There's not mindfulness. There's these other qualities that are fogging out the field, that I can't actually remember the sequence of meanings in a way that is going to be functional. I can't see clearly. So, concentration and ease and pleasure and presence lead to mindfulness rather than the other way around, although it's a little chicken and egg. You have to have both, right? Concentration, ease, and presence are supported by mindfulness, but mindfulness can't be there without some, at least, safety and calm in the system. And then mindfulness brings me into contact with an unfolding sensory experience. Right? When we think of mindfulness, we think of like being mindful of something, mindful of the contact of my body with the cushion, so the sense of weight. You can feel that right now. Mindful of hearing, as you hear these words, you hear the flow of sounds. You might be mindful of the unfolding meaning of the talk, like a way that your mind is kind of understanding a sequence of thoughts. And you could notice that and be mindful of that. Oh, look, understanding is happening. You could be mindful of being distracted from it and thinking about anything, feeling something. You could be mindful of finding what's happening pleasant or unpleasant. Oh, the ache in my tummy, unpleasant. Boring talk, unpleasant. Brilliant talk, very pleasant. Muffins, very pleasant, you know. So mindfulness immerses us in the sensory river. And that river is information coming through all five of the senses all at once, plus thoughts and feelings, which are in a sense interpretive echoes of those physical sensations. And being immersed in that flow, we will either get lost in the interpretive, thinking primarily, or we'll be settled into the sensory. And of course, we oscillate all the time. We swing into the interpretive, we hang out with story for a while. We call that not present. It's actually just as present as anything. It's not like you suddenly disappeared and went into the future, right? Like, that'd be amazing. If every time your mind wandered, you went to where your mind wandered to. Wow. Right? And it's a whole different mystical talk to be like, that's actually what's happening. But, you know, to say that that's what's real, there's a whole realm of discussion around dreams that talks about this. What is a dream? What does it mean to be dreaming and experiencing this profoundly visceral sensory experience and then to just wake up? Did it really happen? Right? It's not easy to say either yes or no there, which is very interesting. And it's interesting philosophically, and it's one of the challenges that philosophy and psychology actually, I think, this is totally a footnote, answer too quickly. Like the answers are too facile for what dreaming is. But yoga, especially the Tibetan variety, to its credit, being a system that deeply investigates the flow of conscious experience, totally has gone there. And you can really, and there's a whole dream yoga that you can do that essentially consists of becoming lucid in your dreams, really being able to say, look, there's a parade of images and sensations flowing through, and I know what's happening. And that means becoming also eventually developing the ability to be developing the sense of lucidity, wakefulness, through even deep sleep, where you could simply be aware of the presence of no stimulus. Oh, like, oh, all my physical senses have shut off. Therefore, I'm aware of the field called nothing. Leave that there. Let's put that over there for now. But just know that it exists, and you can go there if you want. And if you want a really interesting investigation of that, you can go to the teacher, the Western teacher, Alan Wallace, who's a brilliant kind of speaker on things like that. But back to mindfulness and liberation. A little bit of ease and presence brings us into contact with sensory experience. Sensory experience is present. Mindfulness is connection through the senses in the present. And then mindfulness is memory, meaning it's the undistracted focus and connecting with what I'm experiencing. So I'm not just focused, but I'm connecting with unfolding experience that allows me to know what just happened. When I know what just happened, I can feel the connection between what just happened and what's happening now. And this is what Vipassana is. Actually, is that as I start to experience a flow of sensory pings, sensory phenomena, sense moments, mind moments is the technical term, which I don't, is the mind moments, but how's a mind moment? I start to experience a series of things that appear and disappear very quickly. If I'm not distracted and the mind has energy and focus, I can start to string those together. And I can be like, oh, you know, I saw the color blue, and I see your face, and I see the red behind it. And I hear the tone of my voice, and I feel the ache in my belly. And I felt an ache in my belly, and I heard the tone in my voice, and my head turned, and before that I was seeing the red wall, and your face, and the blue sweater. And as I start to string a series of things together, I am supposed to notice some very specific things. And the supposed to is interesting, because, you know, you'd sort of think it would just be like, just do that and see what happens, like not to try to predispose you to see a certain thing. But actually, it's completely built into the text that you're supposed to look for something. So I'm supposed to tell you what you're supposed to see, because it's subtle, and it takes a certain kind of looking to see it. And what you're supposed to see is change. So, for instance, you could see any number of things in sequence. You know, I could see, I like the color blue, I like you, I like the color red, I turn my head, which is kind of neutral, but I recognize that I turned my head because I didn't want to overly focus on you and make you uncomfortable, so I turned my head to focus on something else. And then I felt my belly, which I didn't like, because it is a little achy in this moment. And so then I could track a bunch of things. I could track relationship. I could track my presence in space. I could track the narrative of what I'm doing. I know where I am in the talk, hopefully. I could track the sequence of pleasant and unpleasant, right? That whole sequence went something like pleasant, 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 unpleasant, movement, unpleasant. Yeah, I could track that. And all of that is meant to suggest to us something important. And that important thing is that none of those singular experiences, the pleasure of a color or of a relationship, the painfulness of a sensation or a mind state, none of them lasts for more than an instant, essentially. And in that not lasting is the secret to liberation, when liberation is defined as non-grasping. Yeah, if I really like the color, I might like it so much that I want a sweatshirt in that color. And that would, that might lead me to some suffering. You know, that might at least, not to be overdramatic, right, maybe not very much, maybe a tiny bit, depends how much I grasp. At the very least, grasping onto it, which in a way means leaping from the sensory into the interpretive, right? I go from like the sense ping into like the story around it. What that has done at the minimum is it's interrupted my stream of mindfulness, because while I was getting absorbed in the story about it, I was missing several other things that were happening. Therefore, the stream of remembering has been interrupted, and I won't notice change. The only way to really notice the constant microscopic fluctuations of change, otherwise known as impermanence, is to stay with the flow of things continuously in some focused detail long enough for that spontaneous perception to arise. You have to stay in for long enough to know what's going on. Remember the first time you saw, like, a basketball game, say, on television or live? I kind of remember the first games I ever saw. I don't know if I've ever watched a full game in my life. Admission, not my sport. But lovely, the few times that I have. And seen some part. But I remember the first games I saw, And all I could really see was kind of like a blur of action, right? Like beautiful, tall men dashing back and forth, leaping, crashing, blocking, and this ball flying around. I have no idea what's going on. It's just a mass of activity. And either I find it pleasant or unpleasant or whatever. I have any number of associations, experiences with it. But I don't understand it. And understanding comes after I spend time with it. I listen, I watch it again and again and again. And pretty soon I start to see, like, oh, this is how this team works, and this is what that team does. And oh, here they're doing this kind of maneuver, and here they're doing this kind of maneuver. And my tracking or understanding of what I'm seeing starts to fill in. In other words, I'm being more mindful, and I have a framework to be mindful within. I have a vocabulary for it. Which is why the teaching of mindfulness so often consists essentially of lists to things of things to pay attention to. Pay attention to the body as it sits and stands and walks and lies down. As it sits up, as it adjusts its posture, as it moves the limbs. Pay attention to the breath as it comes in and out, long and short, in the whole body, in part of the body, subtle, gross, happy, sad. And there's a whole list. And then pay attention to pleasant and unpleasant and neutral. And then pay attention to, it goes on and on and on. Right? If I went to someone who does basketball, the thing I would ask them would be like, what should I look for? And they'd be like, oh, look for this. This is great. Did you see that play? That was brilliant. And I'm probably going to be like, no, I missed it mostly. Or I don't know what was brilliant about it. And as I practice and I learn the vocabulary, I'm going to start to see what happened. So the goal is to understand our life. And understanding will come when we have a vocabulary and a framework through which to analyze the play of things. The very fast, chaotic-seeming unfolding of experience. And the tool we have for coming upon that is that we have this body of teachings that will tell us the orientation. Look for this, specifically. Look for this and this and this. And then we have this quality of mindfulness that says, stay with it in a kind of investigative and curious and persistent way until you can actually see these things that we're talking about. And so the first thing to see is impermanence. That nothing that arises in the stream stays for very long. On the large scale, we lose people we love, right? Things that we wanted that we gain, we lose. Things that we wanted we never even get. Things that we didn't want come unwantedly. But also on the micro, right? This very sensation flickers through and changes. This emotion flickers through and changes. And the proposal is that if we really get this, which means really see it, not just kind of cognitively get it, but really see it happen, our tendency to hook onto one flicker in that constant stream, which is often like either something really pleasurable or fulfilling that we want more of, or something really painful that we get attached to by trying to prevent and maneuver around. If we actually see everything flickering so quickly through, here's the rough translation of renunciation, give up trying to manipulate it to save our own skins. And we're just like, oh, whoa, you just stop doing that. And it's really mysterious. When you stop doing that, nothing else particularly changes. You know, you don't magically get happier. Although you very soberly get somewhat happier because not resisting experience is nice. It's nicer than resisting it. But like, your life doesn't suddenly work out. You know, everyone around you suddenly treats you nicely and gives you more money. Like, no. But your complaint about how things are unfolding changes form. into a really interesting kind of intimacy. When I stop being distracted, meaning I stop getting caught by specific flickers in the sensory flow and leap away into thought and story, if I just stay with things, I both get less swept away and more embedded in the life of the body. It actually becomes more embodied and intimate and visceral, and it feels more than when I'm distracted. It seems like it's going to be like, oh, I'm going to lose kind of emotion and engagement and passion and all of the big stuff that the story is about. It's sort of like, you know, I'm going to come out of the game quality and I'm going to be just embedded in action. And in the action of like, oh, this is just what's unfolding. And it turns out to be kind of incredibly poignant. So then mindfulness mindfulness is kind of dangerous. Because strangely, it's this thing that is so helpful in so many, it seems to be so helpful in so many ways, because the process of cultivating it means learning to focus and learning to relax and learning to pay attention. And all those things are helpful in relationships and work and all over the place. But it's almost like I'm coming to the feeling that, you know, if you teach mindfulness without what in Buddhism we would call the view, which is what I'm giving you tonight, like the thing to look for, if you just teach it without telling people to look for impermanence or selflessness or something, maybe it actually just stays a useful training in focus and kind of emotional intelligence and kind of basic qualities of mind that are useful, you know, to come out of anxiety and depression and into the body. Totally beautiful to do. But as soon as you hear the view, as soon as you hear the Dharma that was the foundation of this quality, then your mind may turn toward actually investigating what's happening rather than just focusing. And when you investigate, you see change, and you see that nothing can be clung to, which means really that nothing can be called myself in a permanent, isolating, individual kind of way. Or that the thing I call myself, I can totally call myself, but it just has been changing constantly. Right? How could there be a Sean that exists independently of the fact of having a tummy ache or a non-tummy ache? There's no Sean that's ever existed that has had anything other than either the presence of a tummy ache or the non-presence of a tummy ache. And so, is it the same being? How could I separate those? How could I say there's one being and that the tummy ache is incidental to that being? Oh, there's actually just a being with these conditions and experiences in this moment, and a different being in this next moment with another whole set of sensory experience. So then here's one more mysterious footnote for you. This practice of remembering moment to moment, the practice of mindfulness, and how mindfulness is the intimate tracking of sensory or embodied experience and tracing that experience through time in order to discern subtle, constant change. That is the practice that leads to the insight into your past lives, classically speaking. The teacher that I know that does this practice and teaches it, based in very deep concentration, says essentially, here's the practice. Mindfulness gets very, very, very strong so that memory is extremely precise. And then using that sense of remembering, you remember the last mind moment before this one, and then the one before that, and then the one before that. And you start to, and you are able actually to very quickly rewind through the sensory flow of your life, remembering everything to the moment you were born. And then you remember the moment before you were born. And you remember your way through the crossover in consciousness between a previous life and this one. And to practice it, you just go back and forth across that border a bunch of times. And she says in a very matter-of-fact way, because she's a very matter-of-fact kind of teacher, she says, most people who practice this only really need to do a handful of past lives in order to get the gist. Even though in the text it says the Buddha remembered his past lives 1, 2, 3, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, 100,000,000. She's like, just do a few. And the point is not like I traced my past lives back and I was Cleopatra or whatever. That's not, it's not a mythical or archetypal investigation. It's actually an investigation that just says the conditions under which my consciousness connected with the sensory world have been constantly changing in large and small ways. So you don't even have to think about what happened before your this physical body came into being as a result of your parents, etc. And I often teach it this way. All you have to do is remember being 15 and how different you were and who that was. And if you can trace back to that and then forward to who you are now and connect the two as a string of conditioned mind moments, you are remembering your past lives. And how many lifetimes have you had since then and before that? So mindfulness is memory. The practice of mindfulness is impeccable, intimate tracking of experience. And the instruction is to see that experience so clearly that the reality of impersonal sensory unfolding becomes vividly clear to you. And as that becomes clear, the habit of grasping naturally releases because you can't hold on to snowflakes and raindrops and, you know, the weather as it changes. So why try? So there's a bit on that. Thank you for listening. Your thoughts and feelings. Any questions about practice, reflections in this direction?
So when we slow down time on retreat, yeah, and we lose some of the baggage of sensory stimulus and outside activities,
yeah,
and you can see the space between each ping,
yeah,
with greater ease.
Yeah.
And you're training yourself to do that.
Yeah.
I get that. And then I'm back.
Welcome back.
And I'm like, and the speed of life is not something I can't adjust to the speed of the world around,
yep,
me, the speed of the car, the speed of the things that are in front of me.
Yep.
And I can try and like be so present, mm-hmm. or mindful, mm-hmm. that I, even with, I can see it.
Right.
But I mean, I can grok that intellectually.
Right.
But I'm, like, really present, and I'm, like, homeless encampment. And I'm, like,
yep.
And I don't know how to, I don't know what to do in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Gong concert next door.
Yeah, gong concert. Gong
yeah.
concert.
Gong concert. Totally. Yeah. I mean, this is why, you know, retreat is retreat. And why monastic life has always been, you know, outside of the city in really quiet places. Like, there's nothing about mindfulness that says you have to slow down. But developing the concentration and tranquility necessary to perceive at a very fine grain is dramatically served by slowing down and simplifying. So in a sense, I think, being an urban yogi myself, a lot of what I do is kind of exactly that. Like, everything's going by very quickly. I don't have the conditions to observe in a kind of micro way.
Mm-hmm.
So then, in a sense, you know, I'm just taking the big waves as they come.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like I'm biking along, and my mindfulness is more just like cold air, stink, homeless encampment, thought, and then like sunshine, and then like feeling of my body on the bike. And it's kind of this, like, a handful of seconds, actually, for each kind of thing, you know. Because to attend in a more microscopic way would take me away from actually being appropriately engaged in what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I could do that. I could just be like, you know, pedaling, breeze, seeing people, poverty, criticism, guilt, bike, sun, pleasure, going, YMCA, people, these people, this is happening, my story, my thing. But actually, it's like, you can do that, but even taking that as fast as it comes, you're not actually going to see impermanence.
Right.
Because the story, the interpretive realm is too thick. Really, what you're seeing is more like, this is my life in the city. And you kind of get it on a more psychological or, you know, reduction of basic stress kind of level. Like, I see the homeless encampment, my heart kind of breaks, I hate the whole culture suddenly, and for an instant, I think everything is like terrible capitalist cruelty, and for a moment the whole world goes black, and then I'm mad. And then I get to the next street and I have to look up because I have to track something. And it's just like, in a sense, all I want to really get is that there was this sensory hit and that my heart went, and then it kind of lands, you know. And maybe I want to note the next wave of like, oh, that just aches, you know. And then I want to get like, oh, it kind of explodes and then it just hurts, you know. And then if I go on a long, distracted tangent, and I'll tell you one of my favorites, which was that I have a profoundly rich patron, and then me and a whole bunch of Buddhist activist friends get to take over a massive multi-story thing with a huge park around it, and, you know, and on the ground floor is social services, and on the next floor is the schools, and then the childcare, and it goes and goes and goes and goes, and there's a temple, and there's everything for everybody that needs it, you know, and the money just flows in to make that happen. So I notice myself, I go on that little fantasy, it takes about 3 blocks, and then I kind of come back to the air and the thing. You know? That's all I can do. And then at some point I'm like, oh, I go on retreat, you know, and I use that basic practice then to get to slow down and look in a different way. You know, I get handed the microscope. You know, and the steadying business. So it's just like that.
Yeah.
You know. And there's always been an encouragement in this tradition to, you know, well, what to say? To simplify. But actually, interestingly, if I was to be really specific, I would have to then divide the monastic and the lay practice instructions, which is that the instructions to look deeply at impermanence, which are essentially a renunciation tool, were initially offered to monastics, right? You've given up participating in the more chaotic aspect of life, and you've taken on simplicity in a kind of permanent way. And having done that, now slow down radically and watch things unfold. If you did that to its natural conclusion, as a parent, say, you wouldn't be able to fulfill your duties. And so then the teachings that were given to lay people didn't emphasize that, although the impermanence teachings were given to lay people, as I'm giving them to you now. But the emphasis was on ethical action and, you know, live in the world in a way where you know that your actions have effects and take care of people and, you know, make lots of money and give it all away, basically. Practice generosity. The text says, practice generosity so fully that you're like a gigantic pot that was tipped over and all of its contents poured out to be given away, nothing left. So those were actually the instructions given to lay people. And then when you go on retreat, you get to slow down.
Yeah.
Awesome. That's a good question. Other thoughts here? Yeah.
So you're defining mindfulness by taking in sensory experiences. Sometimes people say things like meditating on a problem, or like working a problem, or you intentionally sit to stay with one thing. Maybe you pass that homeless encampment and you want to be like, I want to actually think about this.
Yeah.
How it makes me feel, my reactions, the bigger. That would be a different thing.
But it would use many of the same qualities or tools, right? Like, I want to stay with it. I don't want to get distracted into thinking about something else. So, you know, I'm thinking about the homeless encampment, and I see all the tents, and I'm like, REI tents are the best. Maybe I could get REI to donate a bunch of tents. Like, that would be a distraction to the primary investigation or whatever, wherever I go to. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we should replace the zipper on that tent that we have, right? Because then we can, you know, like, so you do need focus, and you want to stay with it, and you want to be mindful of it and track it. But you're not doing it with the aim of seeing, you know, the changing nature of mental experience. You're doing it with a different aim, you know, to understand something or to engage with a certain problem. So that would almost be like a samadhi or a concentration state where you have a single object that you're focusing on, like an issue or a problem. And these things totally arise in the texts. So you focus on this thing and then chew on it, investigate it, do inquiry around it. And that's totally a practice. Then you would.
That thing could be an emotional state.
Absolutely.
Like, man, I'm feeling really sad. And
yeah.
Overwhelmed. What does that feel like? And you go into it.
Yeah.
You sort of do describe that in mindfulness.
That's totally mindfulness practice. Right. So then, in a way, what you're doing is you're saying, let me not take this entire experience and just call it heartbreak, as if that kind of defines it, and then I'm satisfied. But let me actually go into it, and being mindful, meaning taking it moment by moment, I'm really going to explore it. Like, oh, what does it feel like as sensation? There's a constriction in my chest. And it's vibrating. And then I see this image of whatever it is, you know, and then the image kind of makes the vibration increase, or whatever, like I stay with it. So then I become mindfulness of it will mean the same thing. It'll mean like stay with it over time in a kind of track your way through it way. And that turns out to be how we can process emotion as well. If process means let it integrate into my being as wisdom and kind of energy, is like I go really into it in the body and stay with it, and it unfolds and changes, and I try not to get distracted. And then it settles in some way, you know, it becomes part of my story in an integrated way. And that's definitely a mindfulness. And then if I stayed with it, I'm going to notice that it changes, right? It's going to disappear, and something else is going to happen. Right? I process something enough, it deactivates, a different emotional state arises. So then mindfulness wants to be present enough to say, oh, look, it changed. Right? That state wasn't permanent, and then I learned from that. I'm like, oh, it so felt like I was going to last forever, but it didn't. And that's this huge thing that I'm, again, being instructed to learn. So very much the emotional process folds into this kind of classical inquiry practice. Mindfulness is the thing that links them. And that becomes a kind of mindfulness-based therapy as well. Essentially, take the quality of mindfulness, apply it to whatever's troubling you, and stay with it until it does its thing, and you understand it and it settles. So, yeah?
The understand it part would then take a thinking about it, not just a being with it.
Understand for me, it's a good question. Understand, I think, means like, this is why we sort of use the old Heinlein word grok, like get in a visceral way on all levels. But yes, understanding will mean thinking about it, and mindfulness can mean thinking about it. It doesn't mean no thought. It really means like, because to get the insight into impermanence, you have to think a little bit about what's happening. I can't just be like, sweatshirt, wall, bellyache. Some part of me has to go, is that a continuous sequence? No. Or in what way is it a continuous sequence? And so I am kind of asking questions about it. If the thinking about it becomes too wordy, it becomes distraction. But if it stays on the level of like intelligent engagement with the question, then that's very much what mindfulness is. And the aspect of the path known as right intention is very often translated as right thought. So it's very much a kind of think about these things practice. Chew on them. So let's try it for just a moment here. So don't like meditate or anything. Mm-hmm. But kind of right where you are. And a really good way to do this, we've done this practice sometimes here, is to give things a little label. And try this one. There's lots of different ways to label. Here's six basic labels, right? A label for each of the physical senses, and then one for the kind of heart-mind, thoughts and feelings. So seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing, and thinking. And you have to know that thinking means thinking and feeling, right? They're not separate. So anything kind of internal, mental, emotional. Yeah? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing, which means body contact, body sensations, or thought. So for a moment, just don't try to do anything, but every couple seconds, give wherever your attention is a label, just in your mind. So what I find is essentially that my attention oscillates every second or so between the visual, the auditory, and the sensation. And then for that short period, I didn't have a lot of extra thinking about, but I would notice that. But a little bit, and I would notice that, like, oh, there's a little thinking about it. And of course, the label is a teeny bit of thought, so you could just know that that's that. it's not a problem. You're using thought to interrupt thought. But anything else? What do you notice doing that? What's it like?
It's really, this struck me when you gave the instruction, but then I kind of experienced it too. But it's really odd to me that, like, to combine thought and feeling as one label, actually.
Yeah.
Especially because I would just put it with sensing, with tactile sensations.
Yeah.
It's just like...
Yeah. So one way you can do it is you can eliminate emotion as a vocabulary word, and you can say that the thing we call emotion is actually a mashup of a bit of thought or story with a visceral or physical sensation. And very often the emotional labels are essentially labels that we use for physical sensations that don't have an easy explanation. So like, my tummy aches, it might have been something I ate, I don't call that an emotion.
Right.
But I feel a subtle fogginess through my whole being, and I don't know why everything feels unpleasant. That's a strange sensation, therefore I have a more complex word for it, called I'm grumpy, or upset, or whatever. So the emotional words are often, you can think of them as descriptions of subtle body sensations, or complex body sensations, and very often they refer also to those sensations being linked to some aspect of my story. And mostly that means that a part of the story gets triggered when I feel a certain complex body sensation, or the story gets triggered by something, somebody says something, or some other sensory thing reminds me of it, and then my body responds by having that sensation. So if you're mindful, you can track them actually as distinct. There's the thought, there's the weird sensation, you know. Oh my God, I have to do my taxes, feeling of dread. What is dread? Oh, it's actually just like it's actually like being washed in a slightly cold, sort of nitrogeny kind of feeling. Right? But not quite, you know? Because it's not just cold, otherwise we just call it cold and not think it's an emotion. I call it dread. And then, you know, this is why poetry, right? It's why you don't just say, you know, oh, I felt dread, but you say, you know, like, yea, though I walk through the shadow of the valley of the shadow of death, you know, it's like, oh, it felt like that, you know, I was walking through a valley and a shadow fell across me and the reality of death hit me, and I was like, whoa, yeah, so that's an emotion, but it's really just a sensation plus a little story. So then it's really mentality, that's the technical unattractive translation of the inner. So you can do just a cognizing as the thing. And a thought does identify that I can have this thing happen that's not bodily, even though you need a body to have one. So at least in the way that we are currently conditioned. Footnote, the brain in a vat hypothesis, just to say, there's no way of knowing we're not in the matrix. That's just a philosophical given, right? The secret Buddhist truth is it doesn't matter, right? You have to...
taking on retreat. My goodness.
I know. You got to come on retreat. It's really good. It's really good. Any other kind of responses to that exercise, right? There's the naming of each thing.
I find it really difficult to put labels on things.
Like the sensory labels?
Yeah, for anything. I don't know if that's because, like, I have an obsession with finding the right words, or if I feel like I've been practicing, like, trying not to name or define things.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's more useful. The kind of, like, I mean, because I can see how putting a name to something can make you more mindful, more aware, and
right.
But then also realizing that, like, the name is impermanent and it's a human construct is also useful too.
Absolutely, the not naming practice is awesome. It's a super good practice. The naming practice is a way to keep you present, as you're saying, and I do really like this variation of it that I'm offering you, where you don't try to find the right word for things.
Mm-hmm.
You just name which sense door it's coming through.
I see.
So, like, I don't try to find a name for the color of the red wall. I just say, seeing. And it doesn't matter what I'm seeing. I don't try to identify the sound or describe what it's doing in me. All that's, like, you could do that. And there's types of noting practice that do that. But I like the practice of just being mindful. This is, of course, one of the early lists. Just be mindful of the flickering of the five senses. And I say flickering because that's about how fast it moves for me, right? It kind of just goes, if I include the objects that it's doing, it goes like seeing the floor, hearing the sock, seeing the wall, seeing the light, hearing the cough, feeling the body, hearing the sock, seeing the floor, seeing the light, hearing the fan, hearing your hmm, seeing the floor. And just like, it kind of just oscillates between these few basic things. And if you look at it very closely, what it's doing is it's stitching together the story of what's happening, right? It's just going, I see this, I hear this. It's actually doing it way faster than I'm speaking it. And the perception, cue the teaching image of a film strip that has separated still frames and space between them, right? The perception is of movement. And one of the strange experiences that happens deep into Vipassana retreat is that this pinging of constant things starts to feel like a ratchet or a strobe light, which is to say you can start to perceive the empty spaces between them. The first time I felt this, I was in Burma on retreat. I'd been doing noting practice every 2 seconds, naming what's happening, for about 4 months without a break. Lots of distraction, but trying to do it without a break. And at one point, I was giving up and lying down for a nap, which is usually when good stuff happens, because you've finally given up. Mm-hmm. And at last, you relax enough to actually be present. And I lifted my hand to change something in my robes or the mosquito net or something. And instead of feeling my arm just move, which I'd been tracking for months, I felt like it was going. In other words, I felt each little moment of movement and then a flicker of space and then a new little burst of movement. And this is a classic experience that you're supposed to have. Whatever. It's kind of weird. But I was like, oh, that! Ha ha! I'm so glad they told me I was supposed to have that because now I recognize it. But you can start to recognize that and be like, oh, that's what's happening. It's strobe-like. Yeah? And as you get deeper in practice, you start to notice the gaps and actually just notice that everything like disappears as soon as it appears. And then shit starts to get funky. In a way that is, again, supposed to happen. Because the only way to not cling, actually, is to let go of everything as soon as it arises. And you only do this on retreat, pretty much. Right. So that's the purpose of that practice. And yeah, don't get too stuck in trying to find the right words for things. Or if the non-labeling practice actually feels more like just the right thing for you, like that's what your system wants to rest into or learn or practice, then yeah, don't label. You know, do what feels most helpful, of course. Cool. So thank you for being here. It's really a pleasure. As always, we're fully on your generosity being what makes the group possible. Thank you for your generosity. Everything you offer goes to the studio and myself and the continuing of this as a space that's open to all and resists the capitalist force just slightly. So thank you for that. Donations in the box in there. There's also a mailing list there if you want to hear from me about classes and things. Write your email. You can also give at the desk in other forms. And see you around very soon. Take good care.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, thank you.